recording.
Hello, this is a podcast for Monday, February 25th, 2013. Theories of Knowledge. Yes?
Was both the chapters on Clifford and James doing today?
Right, so today we're going to talk about, actually, last week was Clifford. So today, William James and Kierkegaard, maybe today, mostly on Wednesday. And then next week is religious knowledge, and then week 10, social and political knowledge. So this week, William James, Soren Kierkegaard, and then some general stuff about how much control you have over your beliefs. That's that whole, just a couple of pages on volitionism at the end of the section. And then David Hume and religious knowledge next week. And then moral and political knowledge in week 10. And that'll be the end of the term. A couple of reminders about the add drop deadline. Also, the deadline to change your grading option from letter grade to pass, no pass, or from pass, no pass to letter grade. And that deadline is Friday at 5. So make sure to make those changes in time. Often students will come to me and they'll be, say, failing the class. They don't want their GPA to take a hit. And they ask if I can change their grade to pass, no pass. No can do. I can't do those things. That's up to you, and you have till this Friday at 5 to do that. Also, if you want to bring your grade up, there's an extra credit test, and I'm going to open that today. And I didn't get a chance to do it before class, but after class, I'll open that up. And so it's based on material from both the first and second exams. And same number of questions, so it's taken the materials roughly half from the first exam, half from the second exam. It will replace your lowest test score. Whether that lowest test score is the first exam, the second exam, or even the final that you've yet to take, it'll replace whatever grade is lowest. It is not a substitute for the final. So in order for this to, let's see, I guess I'll just say that if you take the first two tests and the extra credit test, but don't take the final, you're probably not going to pass the class because this is not a substitute for the final. So if you've taken all three tests, it will replace your lowest score. If you're missing one of the tests, what will it do? It'll replace your lowest score that isn't a zero. How's that? So you need to take all three of the tests. And it's the same deal. It's in the testing lab. You get a 3x5 card, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Will it always replace the lowest score, or only if it's higher than the lowest score?
It will only replace your lowest score if it's higher than your lowest score. So it won't hurt you. It can only help you. So if you take the extra credit exam and you get worse than any exam you've yet taken in the class, you still haven't hurt yourself. So it's you have everything to gain and nothing to lose except for maybe some extra studying time. Let's see. So those are the main announcements. So make sure to keep your eye on that deadline Friday at 5 for making those schedule changes. You can also drop the class if you've got stuff going on or you think there's no way you can pass. There's no shame in cutting your losses. Not that I'm encouraging anyone to drop. I'm just saying I've had a couple of students that come in and I remember one time I told the student that I'm like, you didn't do too well in these first two exams and I don't have a good feeling about this next exam based on what we've just talked about. You might want to think about dropping the class. And then he like goes on ratemyprofessor.com and says, this guy, he told me, he threatened me with a bad grade if I didn't drop the class. I'm like, that's not what I was doing at all. I was just trying to do him a favor. And anyway. Okay, so like I guess that's it for as far as announcements go. I had one more about grades. So the new Moodle keeps on sticking these letter grades in there when they didn't exist before. And so I've turned off the totals, and I've turned off like the category totals. So the only thing now you can see is the grades on particular assignments. So I'll send out an announcement later today about how you calculate your grade. Roughly in this class, it's, you know, the breakdown is. Oh. How that happened? I must have picked up a pen that was in one of the classrooms. That wasn't mine. I'm not hitting anybody. We're trying to hit the trash can in the back. Okay, so the breakdown, it's 30, 30, 30, 10, right? So it's first midterm, second midterm, final, and then the forums. So it's easy to calculate your grade using some elementary algebra, which you all know from grade school, right? Oh, no, guess not. Darn government schools. Okay, so it's, you know, 0.3 times whatever your score is. Say it was an 80. Do the stuff inside the parentheses first. Plus 0.3 times, say you got a 70. Plus 0.3 times, say you got a 90. Plus whatever your forms are. So let's suppose you did all 10. So just use whole numbers there, right? So you're going to end up with a whole number that's from 1 to 100. And so here, it, 24,
21, and 27.
7 plus 10. So this person would have 45, 65,
82.
72, 82. Good. That'd be a B minus. Just on the cusp of a B. So, if you're between grades, and sometimes you'll get bumped up to the next one. Yeah.
Where do you cut your grades off?
So it's in the syllabus, but 82 is the top of the B minus scale. So, and sometimes if there's improvement, like if I see the person that got a 70 on the first test, an 80 on the second, maybe an 85 on the third, and they took the extra credit exam, they actually got a 90. I'm like, oh, okay, that's improvement. And they did all their form posts, but they're still down there at 82. I'm like, okay, well, they've shown improvement. And so I tend to bump people up that show improvement. If you show the opposite trend, it's like you start out with a 90, and then it was 80, and then it was 70. And especially if your form posts are, like, really crummy, because that's sort of like you do it and you get credit. Then I see that, oh, this person, they were doing something right the first time, but now they're in this steady decline. Instead of getting better, they're getting worse. Oh, I guess 82 is the grade they deserve, and I'd probably give you a B minus. So, if you come by my office for help or in reviewing, I know you're really trying. I tend to give you a brownie points if a person's between grades. If you're on the cusp of the next higher grade, I tend to give you the benefit of the doubt. So since you haven't taken the final, this number here, you can just, fill it in with whatever you think you're going to get, whatever you expect to get. Or you can play around with this and plug in different numbers and see what might turn up. Okay, so that's, let me erase this fresh word. I'll send out this formula, too, on the announcements. Okay. Also, if you want to look at if you haven't already reviewed your second exam, you should be able to do that, I'll say, at 3:30, because I was just working on that when I got interrupted. And so so you can go in there and just, again, to review your test, either the first exam or the second exam, if you haven't already done it. You get one review to look at the correct answers. You just submit a blank test. It doesn't count. don't try to get a better score because it's not going to count. I mean, you can if you want for practice or something, but just if you just want to see what the correct answers are, just submit a blank test, and then it'll show you all the answers, and then you can look at them all and see which ones you might be iffy about. Read all the questions. Stay there as long as you like. You can't take any notes or anything. If you want to come by and go over your tests in detail, question by question, you're going to have to come by office hours or make an appointment with me. And that's just because of the way the testing lab's set up. It's got this thing where if you want to review your test, it exists outside the firewall, in which case people could download and print out tests and stuff like that. And that defeats the whole idea of test security and using the lab in the first place. Yeah.
If we put our names on our note cards, will you get them back to us, or are they gone forever?
No, you can get them back. Make sure to put your notes on them. Let's see, did I get the first? I'm trying to think if they've given me those note cards from the first exam back yet. I'll go see if I got the ones from the first exam back. I think they might be sent in my office someplace. But I can definitely get those back. I'll try to bring them to class next time. So definitely put your name on them if you want to get them back. What happens is they collect them, and then after the test is over, they hand them off to me, and then I can bring them to class and can get yours. Okay, let's talk about William James. So before getting to James, I guess James, notice that James in his article talks a lot about another reading we had. By which author? First born up here. Clifford, right? So James is talking a lot about Clifford. James, regarded as one of the fathers of modern psychology. He also wrote a book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which was really influential in academic study of religion. Very famous person, psychologist. Religious scholar, and he's famous for his view, pragmatism. What does it mean to be pragmatic about something?
To believe in things only for their use.
Uh-huh.
Only believe in things that are useful in some way in your reality. Practical.
Focus on what's useful or practical. You know, as opposed to what? How about principle? Or you might also say theory. Or even, you might say truth. James actually is famous for his pragmatic definition of truth, which is what's useful is true, and what's true is useful. And then he'd say, but I want to distinguish my sense of truth from the real definition of truth, which is corresponds with reality. And so he really understands that's not really what truth means, but what he really, I think, is trying to say in that essay where he's really supposedly defines truth as that which is useful. It's just that you should not just pay attention to what reality is like, but pay attention to what beliefs will serve you. And those two things aren't necessarily the same. There might be some cases in which knowing the facts isn't going to serve you, and particularly knowing certain kinds of facts. And maybe there may be other cases where having a belief, which may not even be backed by evidence, is going to serve you more than not having that belief. And so his focus is on pragmatism. You see this in politics a lot, this idea of trying advocating for the pure candidate who has no chance of getting elected or less chance of getting elected, as opposed to the political insider who has a better chance of getting elected, but he doesn't have, you know, the principles you'd like him to have. You'll find a principled politician is a tough job, right? So there's always this conflict in politics. wanting to elect somebody who's going to do some good, but also wanting to have a candidate that once you get elected, they're actually going to be better than the other guy. And so sometimes you see like examples of this voting for the lesser of evils. Right, so you've heard the lesser of two evils. You know, so the idea is you go for the guy that's least bad. Even though maybe there's a third party candidate, you say, that's the guy I like. But you say, oh, it's so close right now, and it could be this guy or that guy, and I'm going to throw my principles out the window. This guy's less bad, so I'm going to vote for him. I had a t-shirt in my closet that says, why vote for the lesser of evils? Cthulhu for president. If you know who Cthulhu is, he's this
vote for the most
evil. Yeah, that he's like the personification of evil. Anyway, so voting for the lesser of evils, or you might another example. Let's see. Voting for the lesser of evils.
This is an example of pragmatism.
Pragmatism, right? You know, voting for. The person who can get elected, you know, with some good principles. Versus just like the best candidate. The candidate with the best principles. Especially if you have like a blue state like Oregon, you're not going to get like if you're a, sort of a conservative type. There's no way like a really strong conservative could get elected in Oregon. So you know, you run a moderate candidate saying he's the guy who can win, even if you have conservative principles. You're like, oh yeah, I guess I'll vote for this guy because he actually has a chance of beating the Democrat. On the other hand, if you're a Democrat living in Texas, you might say, well, I really like this, like, you know, really liberal Democrat guy, but they have no chance of winning, so I'm going to vote for this more moderate Democrat who has a chance of winning in Texas, that sort of thing. So now, how does this work when you're talking about beliefs? What is it to be pragmatic with regard to truth? Believe what's good for you, what will serve you, make you happy, give you hope. Motivate you versus what's true, you know, or provable. So that's the basic idea. You want to believe those things that are going to make you a happier person. That might not be the same as what's true. There might be some, or, and it also might not be the same as what you can prove. And so, James says that most of the time, you're going to be better off going with the evidence. But there's some circumstances where these considerations, these practical considerations about the effect a belief has on your life, should trump evidence and only believing things on sufficient evidence. And so when he's talking about Clifford, I think one important point to keep in mind is that he generally agrees with Clifford. So what does Clifford say about evidence? In and then how evidence should be related to your... How should your belief be related to the evidence? Olive.
You should pay attention to the evidence, really do a thorough research on what you would like to believe.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't?
Well, you're ridiculous and you should not believe anything.
You're a bad person, right? You've left a stain that can never be wiped away, right? You've committed a sin against all mankind, because here, you know, as human beings came down from the trees, they created science and technology and civilization, and through slow, arduous steps, we've crawled up from our mud huts and our primitive superstitions, and now we've got airplanes and computers. Well, not at Clifford's time. I suppose at Clifford's time you had the steam engine and clocks and the beginnings of dentistry. You think about modern technology, right? Modern medicine, all the things that make life good. Today we have computers and iPads and air conditioning and genetic engineering and all this open heart surgery and all this cool stuff. And what are you doing? You're looking at your astrology chart, which is like a primitive superstition from 4,000 years ago, where people stared up at the little dots in the sky and thought that somehow they were gods and that they had an effect over your life. Or you're doing something like you're telling your friend about your sort of quack health cures. And how about if you ever get cancer, you're going to go on a macrobiotic diet like Steve Jobs and end up dying. Except for you think, oh, Steve was just doing it wrong. Or you're going to treat your malady with prayer or something like that, because chemotherapy, that's just chemicals. The chemicals are bad. And so, you know, what Clifford would say is that you're spitting in the face of every scientist who ever lived when you start spouting nonsense, not just about science or technology or about medicine, but just about any topic when you don't check it out. Because you're where you are today and are able to enjoy the life you have today because people took care to proportion their belief to the evidence and were really interested in finding out the truth. And what you're doing is you're not only disrespecting yourself, but you're also causing bad effects to the people around you. All right. You're the wonders of technology, right?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Clifford sees you, you're like, when you have some unjustified beliefs, you're like Typhoid Mary serving up the soup. I don't know if anybody remember about Typhoid Mary.
Yeah.
She's this woman, she's like a food service worker. That was like her passion, I guess, was like serving soup. And they let her go and say, now Mary, you stay away from those soup lines because you got the typhus and you're going to give it to everybody. And she'd be there, you know, serving people right again, and they'd have to arrest her again. And she was a carrier, so she didn't actually have it, but she was spreading it around other people. Well, when you start spouting off nonsense, you give credence to other people. You nod your head and say, oh, that's really interesting, and validate somebody's wacko theory about, you know, pick on anybody in particular, but, you know, the conspiracies that the government was behind 9/11, or the idea that, people can levitate with no... without a gizmo or something, that they could, or that you can create your own reality through the power of your mind. And then, you know, people pick up on that. They might, you know, take that to heart and then have something really bad happen to them. Maybe you're going off on how modern medicine is all cut and burn. Now, if we treated our maladies naturally with sunlight and organic yams, that everybody would be perfectly healthy. And then maybe somebody gets cancer and they're like, oh, I'm going to go eat organic yams and go down to a health clinic in Mexico where I get coffee enemas all day or something, and it's going to cure my cancer. And the person ends up dying. And this happens to people every year. They they die of a heat stroke in a sweat lodge, or they join some crazy cult and end up committing suicide, or being forced to commit suicide by their fellow cult members when they try to run away, like in with Jim Jones in the People's Temple. Or maybe they just get snookered by some politician through the lazy habits they've developed of just, you know, spouting off things. And people spout off things, and people nod their heads and say, oh, I guess that's as good as any other theory. Oh, all beliefs are equal. Without being challenged. And so I think that's Clifford's view, that we need to become a nation of critical thinkers, that you ought to be embarrassed to share any belief that you don't have any evidence for, that when you're spouting nonsense to other people, you're like a disease vector spreading your illness to everyone, and that it's really important to have evidence to back up your beliefs. And Jane sort of chuckles, I think, at the gusto with which Clifford rams home his point. You know, Clifford is you can tell he really gets exercised about this stuff. And he talks about the pathos in which he preaches his gospel of evidence. And James says, you know, I pretty much agree with Clifford, but there are sometimes the evidence isn't enough, and sometimes you need to go beyond the evidence. So what are those cases? James actually has three conditions, all of which must be met. And then and only then can you exercise what he calls the will to believe. But under three conditions, you may exercise your will to believe. You get to decide what to believe. Despite the evidence, or even if there isn't sufficient evidence for it. So somebody just give me one. Yeah.
Forced.
Yeah, forced option. Is that the first one? Oh, we don't take these in order, I guess.
Living
forced
momentum.
Let's start out with living. Maybe we'll take it in order. What is a living option? We have an option between two beliefs. So it's believe A or believe B. Just keep it simple. You know, the real world, there's C, D, E, and F. But he gives a couple examples in there. A Mohammedan, by the way, is a Muslim, in case you didn't know. And also it's insulting to Muslims to call them Mohammedans, so don't do that. It's a kind of an old-timey reference, and it's not politically correct. It's like calling a black person a Negro. So it's a Muslim. So it's one of the examples. He talks about a Muslim getting baptized with holy water, or having holy water sprinkled on him. And he talks about whether or not a Muslim would think like that having a Catholic priest put holy water on him would do him any good. So why would that not be a living option?
Because it doesn't have an appeal of interest. He says that a living option is when both hypotheses are live ones, meaning each hypothesis makes an appeal depending on the individual's belief.
Mm-hmm. So it's more than just like interest or appeal, but you're right, it's based on that person's beliefs. So where does that person get their beliefs?
Their culture.
Yeah. Good. So you have your so living option. It means given your culture, and maybe we can talk about your background, and maybe talk about your experiences, it's possible for you to believe it. So it's just, it has to be something that it's impossible, meaning but psychologically possible. So can you think of a person of a certain background or culture And then think about a belief it would be psychologically impossible or unrealistic for a person to have. Like, I have a friend who's like raised as like a, his parents were both militant atheists. They were from East Germany. They came over here after the wall came down. And actually, maybe it was before. I think they actually got out. They snuck out when the Iron Curtain was still down. So, I guess the Berlin Wall came down in 89. Yeah, he would have been over here before that. So anyway, East German, you know, and his father and mother are both militant atheists, and they raised him from the time he was so high to think that belief in God is like believing in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, and it's just a fairy tale made up by the capitalist oppressors. And then later on, they're still kind of socialistic, but they sort of seen the light. But they have this sort of still have this kind of communist idea that religion is a tool for social control by the elite, and there's no reality behind it. And that's what they raised him with. And so he says, you know, it's not like I could choose to believe in God. It's like ever since I was so small, the idea of God just seemed like a total fantasy to me, and it still does. And I don't understand how anybody could believe in God. So to tell that person, oh, you can believe in God, that you can exercise your will to believe in believing in God. Excuse me. Still getting over my cold. I'm actually over it, but there's a bunch of gunk in my throat that I haven't hopped up yet. Maybe in the middle of class. So for him, believing in God isn't really even psychologically possible. It's not an option. Yeah, God is dead to him. that's a good way of putting it.
Isn't that more atheism than agnostic?
That's what he said, atheism.
Yeah, I think he'll be an atheist. Oh, sorry, I said God, you said God is dead to him. And that's like, yeah, God is dead to him.
No, I mean like a dead option.
Yeah, it's a dead option, right. Oh, there's that famous cover of Time magazine, God is Dead. Quoting the philosopher Nietzsche. Well, to him, God really is dead. It's a dead option. It's not like he has a choice. Oh, I could believe in God or I couldn't believe in God. To him, it's like, oh, I could believe in Santa Claus or I could believe or not believe in Santa Claus. It's not like an adult, educated person could actually believe in Santa Claus. Now, you couldn't believe that any more than you could believe that Abraham Lincoln was, you know, what I'm going to think of that Abraham Lincoln was a Russian spy or something. Yeah. I think how Abraham Lincoln was the first president of the United States. Could you ever, like, once you learn that Abraham Lincoln, you know, what was the president during the Civil War, could you ever make yourself believe that he was the first president of the United States? I mean, it's like you couldn't do it, right? You couldn't do that any more than you could believe that there's, you know, four fingers in front of your face when there's five, or that two and two is five, or that the moon is made of green cheese. It's just not a possibility.
So it's like you can't unlearn something that you already have it implanted in your head.
Yeah, I think James thinks that certain things, it's just those things are dead to you. Now, I don't know if you could resurrect them in some way, or, you know, he doesn't go into a lot of detail, but that's what he means by a living versus a dead option. It has to be something that you could actually believe given your background and circumstances and your history and so on.
Or like something that's still possibly debatable for you?
Yeah. So it's, and this is going to depend on like who you are, so it's somewhat, it's relative to the person. What's living or dead to that person. So for other people, belief in God, you know, might be a completely living option. To a five-year-old, believing in Santa Claus might be a living option, right? So it just depends on your circumstances. So this is, again, James sort of being realistic with regard to what people can believe. So that's just, you know, for starters. The second one, it has to be a forced option. What does forced mean? Somebody shoves a belief down your throat?
Against your will.
No, that's actually not what it means.
There's no standing place outside the alternative.
Yeah, maybe, go ahead. You had your hand.
Yeah, it's like you either have to choose one side or the other. There's not really an in-between gray area. You have to either say yes or no.
So you must choose. Now, what is the? What happens if you don't? Must choose or else. Or else what? Well, or else you miss out on something important. So think about like. Or there's some consequence. Now I'm confusing this with momentous. I don't want to confuse this.
I was going to say, isn't it the chance to, like, you might miss that more momentous?
I want to put it this way. There's a you miss out on an opportunity.
Isn't that momentous guilt?
Not if it's a really small opportunity, or face a negative consequence. And maybe I should talk about momentous with that too, and then it'll all come together. Momentous. What does momentous mean?
When you're faced with a unique opportunity, and if you yes or no, and if you say no, you miss out on that unique opportunity. Whereas the opposite, trivial, is an opportunity.
Right. So there's the difference between the you have to choose yes or no. You can't put it off. And maybe the force, another way of putting it, you can't put it off. But then you would say, well, what if I do put it off? Then what happens?
Okay,
and a negative consequence, or you miss out on something. Like, I remember a forced choice, right? So I wanted to go see my voice instructor, Gene Pinn, in his show Next to Normal, and I had a choice of dates, and then I got sick, and I'm like, oh well, I could go on this date, or I can go on this date, or I could go on this date, you know, and so I had a whole bunch of dates I could choose from, and so I came a point where I had to choose whether or not I was going to go on the last day, and I decided not to. That was a choice I made, right? It was forced, because if I didn't go on the last night, I would never see Gene in his show. And it turned out I didn't go to his show, right? And there was something else going on this weekend, some sword and sorcery play down in Cottage Grove that I didn't go to. Did you guys see that?
Yes.
You were in it? See, I blew it. I totally missed it. I was like, oh, I could go, but I'm so tired and I'm still sick. Oh, but maybe it'll be cool. Oh, but I don't know anything about the show. I wish they had a Facebook page. I had more information. And I'm like sort of going back and forth. Anyway, so I didn't go, and so I missed out, right? Now, was it momentous? Well, maybe it was momentous, right? But it's not the same as like losing an opportunity to climb Mount Everest. Or if I like won the lottery and I've got the ticket, but I missed the day that I have to cash on my ticket. I don't get my $1 million or something. So momentous, I think, is really important in the grand scheme of things. In the grand scheme of your life. So you look at your overall life and I think about, you know, missing those two great shows, it's kind of a loss, but it's not like it's an earth-shattering loss. The same thing, you can think of like a really trivial thing, right? So like if it's raining outside and you're trying to decide whether to take your umbrella, you have to either, if you carry an umbrella, but if you don't want to get wet, you can either take the umbrella or you can leave it in the car. You got to choose, right? That's the forced.
No.
But it's not momentous, though.
But I thought, okay, this is how I read it. In the book, I read that if you can choose between going out with your umbrella or not, you also have the option to not go out, so that is not a forced option, because you can get out of the whole thing.
Okay, right.
But, like, if you have, like, a one side or the other decision, uh-huh. and there's no way out of making that, like, you can't get out of making the decision at all, then it's forced.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah. That's good. And so it's kind of funny because that's a kind of depends on how you set it up. I mean, I suppose you could, like, live the rest of your life without going out of the house, like some, you know, a person with agoraphobia or something like that. But eventually you got to come out. And given that you're going to work or to school or something like that, then if you have to go someplace, you have to choose to take your umbrella or not. How about, like, a good way to think about, like, an unforced choice about who killed JFK? Right? Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone? It's like, I've read several books on the subject. I've seen a bunch of documentaries. Hey, I have no idea what I believe now, because I see good arguments on either side. And so what can I do? I can just sort of push it off, right? I can say, well, it doesn't really affect me, so I'm just going to withhold belief and not come down on one side or the other. It could be the magic bullet. It could be that Lee Harvey Oswald was like a double agent for the Soviets. You know, it could be it was the mob. It could be it was, you know, Johnson was behind it all. I mean, there's all these different theories, right? And so I don't have to choose. I can just say, oh, it's kind of interesting thing, and I can tell you one way or the other. I can put it off indefinitely. I don't have to make the choice. So that's, and you can think of lots of things like that. You might say, oh, that's kind of interesting. I haven't really made up my mind about, you know, whatever it is. The global warming, right? So if you're not really sure about global warming, you can just sort of put it off. It's not like you have to make a choice. I suppose you could be like this guy I met at a coffee shop who sold his car and rides his bicycle everywhere because he thinks we're heading for an eco-catastrophe based on global warming. But for most people, your carbon output's really not going to affect the planet that much. And so you can just sort of put it off and say, well, I want to study it a little more. And you can just keep on putting it off. Lots of philosophical issues, right? You can just keep on putting them off. This third thing, the momentous, says it's like something that's really important. And so I think James would say you don't want to put off important things. So what kinds of beliefs would fall into these categories then? That would be where it's living, it's forced, and it's momentous. But maybe you don't have enough evidence for the belief. We're thinking about beliefs, not actions here. He uses actions to illustrate what he means by forced and momentous, but he's really talking about beliefs. Well, James says belief in God belongs here.
For momentous.
Yeah, he would say that it's all three of these, that it needs the...
Wait, were you saying JFK was momentous? Like,
no, it's not momentous. Because it's like it doesn't, you know, does that have any effect on my life? Not really. Same thing with the 9/11 conspiracies or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, they happen. So, but
I already know the government's bad and evil.
Yeah. A living one could be like the witch doctors or whatever in like the Amazon or whatever, the shamans that like. They cure people by taking out the demon in them.
Uh-huh.
And then there's modern Western science that cures someone through chemicals.
Right,
like,
so that would be...
living beliefs, kind of.
So are you saying like a person in the West?
Well, because it's like part of the people's culture, like,
uh-huh.
to like believe that that's how you cure someone. And so maybe they're right, maybe we're right, I don't know.
It's like, it seems like more of it. It seems liquid, right?
Well, I would say, I mean, that would be a dead option to me. That seems like silly superstition.
Yeah. I mean,
But there might be some people here that, like, you know, are more.
But it appears to the culture. It's like, it's like,
but the people, if you're raised in the Aboriginal culture, though, maybe, I mean, that would be a living option for you to believe in it. But I would say that for a person, it's kind of hard with growing up in Eugene, because I get students every term that say, who are we to judge whether, like, some guy with a scary mask shaking a rattle over somebody is actually, you know, sending healing vibrations to that person and curing them. And maybe might do a better job than a brain surgeon at a U.S. medical center. And I just say, well, you know, I don't know what to say about that except for I am. And it seems like that what reason do you have to believe that someone who's wearing a scary mask and shaking a rattle is doing anything to help somebody? Except for maybe giving them a placebo effect. Yeah.
So James says that the belief in God is living force and momentous.
Right. Right. So it since it meets all three of those criteria, and remember, all three criteria are necessary for you to be able to exercise your will to believe.
Right.
So a belief must be living, forced, and momentous, and then you can say, I don't have enough evidence, but I'm going to believe it anyway because it's good for me. Because it will fill my life with hope and meaning and purpose, because it'll help me get up in the morning and get through the day. Because it'll make me happy.
It seems like we have a problem, though, with the living, since it's a subjective option.
Uh-huh.
So to me, God does not fall under a living option. So to me, it's not, you know, it's not a belief that can be...
You're an existentialist or something. You'll be depressed all the time.
But,
be staring at the ceiling, the contemplating your immortality. Unless you have your head frozen in cryonics or something like that. Or the singularity comes before you die. But I know what you mean. He would say that it is person specific. Now, I think James would deny that God is not a living option for anybody. But I think he's probably wrong about that. So, yeah, what James, and again, James living in the 19th century where atheism is like really fringy, and Europe was becoming somewhat secular, but not as much as it is today. And now today, you know, even the United States society is so secular that you know, it's becoming less of a living option for more and more people. So he would say, but there might be some other things that might meet those three criteria for you, though.
Right, but I'm just saying the living options in general. For me, it could be one thing, and then for another person, something that is living to me could be dead to them.
Right.
So all belief under this kind of pragmatism is just subjective.
It seems relativistic. Is that the thing?
Yeah.
So, I suppose.
Isn't that what James is saying as a whole? That we can have relative beliefs if they are living force and momentous to us?
I think what he's saying is you can't make yourself believe something you can't make yourself believe.
Okay.
In other words, he's talking about, do you have the right to do something? To exercise a will to believe, even though you can't prove it. Even though you don't have enough evidence. And James says, yes, if you meet these criteria. The first criteria is you have to be able to believe it, right? Because you can only have a right to do something that it's possible for you to do. Like, it doesn't make any sense for me to talk about, do I have the right to jump to the moon? Well, it's not possible for me to jump to the moon. So whether I have a right to do it doesn't even come up or make any sense. And so to talk about what you're within your rights to believe, you have to start out with what you can believe. And I guess James, being a psychologist, is sufficiently, you know, realistic about what's within the range of possibility of people's beliefs that he wants to sort of start out at that place. So it's not relativistic. I mean, it's relativistic in the sense that he recognizes that people have different backgrounds and have different limits to what they can believe. But that might just be a concession to psychological realism, that people have different abilities. And you might compare it to, like, you know, saying that women have to do fewer pull-ups when they get drafted into the military than men do, because they have less upper body strength naturally. That's not necessarily having relativistic standards, just recognizing that human anatomy, you know, is different from men and women. Hopefully something we noticed when we were very young. Did you have a point, or is it gone now? Okay. Anything else that would, like, go in here, like, think about things that you really don't have sufficient evidence for, but that maybe will make your life better? Yeah.
Maybe, like, you were talking about cryonics, you know, if before you die, you want to maybe live past your life expectancy, or whether or not you want to freeze yourself here.
Yeah, so there's not sufficient evidence for that, maybe. But I mean, there's some evidence, but it's not enough, sure. So that might be like materialist immortality there. Yeah.
Yeah, afterlife.
Uh-huh. And that doesn't necessarily, you know, you might put God in the afterlife over here with God, but God and the afterlife usually go hand in hand, but not necessarily. There's, like, I think there's some spiritualists that think there's just spirits and spirits, but there's no sort of absolute spirit or super spirit. And some people believe in God but don't believe in the afterlife too. Like, ancient Judaism is like that. You have God and you serve God for the rewards and punishments in this life that you'll get depending on whether you serve Him or not. And then when you die, you know, dust you are and to dust you'll return. And the idea of a soul didn't come about till later when they ran into the Zoroastrians. Anything else you want to throw in there? Maybe that will make your life better, but you can't prove. How about things like love? Or maybe morality? Or free will?
Google blessings.
Yeah, so, well, now you're dealing with, like, an object as opposed to a belief. So. But, yeah, someday I'll have a flying car, you know. But you think about things, you know, can you prove that your significant other loves you? Are you going to put it to an empirical test? Are you going to be, you know, can you prove they're faithful to you? Are you going to hire a detective to follow them around and see what they do all day? You know, most people know. They just sort of accept it on faith that they're in this relationship. They trust this other person, right? And you might put friendship in here, too. And that implicit trust isn't something that you're subjecting to rigorous canons of evidence. It's something you just sort of accept as being true, and you trust that other person, whether it's in a romantic relationship or a friendship or even, I suppose, a business partnership, depending on whether you're going on the handshake or the contracts.
Emotions, like happiness, sadness?
Well, those aren't, you know, are those really beliefs?
But
I see what you mean. Like, so love might be a good example. So love is sort of ambiguous between, you know, love is an emotion, but it's also like it's a relationship, or it's a concept. And some people who are, like, jaded, who will say, oh, it's, you know, love is just it's a sham. It's a word that was made up to sell greeting cards, or it was a concept made to sell women on the idea that they could become property of their husbands. Or it's, you know, so people, there are some people who are really cynical about love, Or they'll say it's all basically, you know, what happens when all the sex dies down. And it's like, you call that love, and it's sort of, or it's a bunch of brain chemicals that are making you feel a certain way. And it's nature's way of trying to get you to reproduce the next generation. Yeah, Patrick?
I was just going to mention the brain chemicals. It's just the...
Right, like love is oxy.
Your brain plays like
there you go. Love is oxytocin, right? It's a chemical secreted with your blood brain that makes you feel funny, that makes you, it's that chemical that makes you want to stay with the person you just mated with in order to make sure that your progeny doesn't die prematurely. You're like protecting your part of the gene pool. Or you can believe in, you know, love and the idea of a lifelong relationship and you know, the idea of a partnership and commitment and all those sorts of things, which are, you know, it's a more of a sort of lofty thing. But can you really prove that? And can you prove that you have true love with the partner you're with? And, you know, it's not like you can prove that in the same sense you can prove other things. So the same thing about, you know, morality or the fact that you have free will, those are things that maybe you can't necessarily prove, but you kind of accept. Why? Because believing them gives your life meaning and value. It makes you a happier person. Believing in free will means you're not going to like sit around all day in your butt thinking, oh, I'm a victim of circumstance. Oh, I'm a victim of society. You get up and do things. And so free will is one of those things that the more you believe in it, the more freely you act. And so even if you are a product of genetics and conditioning, believing in free will is going to make you a happier person, because studies show that the people who feel a sense of control over their lives are happier and better adjusted. They achieve more worthwhile things that people value, and so on. So let's, again, pragmatism. What, you know, what will make your life better? Comments or questions on James, William James, or criticisms? What about this idea of God being getting a pass because he fulfills this criteria? Yeah.
These criteria according to James himself, because like what we were saying earlier, it's all relative. And to go back to your prior example of the boy who was raised under an atheist household, it's not living to him, so therefore it doesn't fit under this criteria.
Well, he might say that it's the criteria is might be just applied to different individuals differently. So if there is a person who really can't believe in God, James would say, well, he can't exercise his will to believe in God, but other people can.
But other people can.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it lowers the bar a little too low. It's really relativistic about what is living, what's dead, and to call these beliefs true beliefs, I think they're false beliefs. I don't think that with our definition, like, we can justify any of them and call them knowledge. I like more what the person in the chapter
Clifford said,
and I liked what he said a lot more.
Amanda.
Well, we're not calling it knowledge, though. We're calling it beliefs. So I think that, personally, I think that beliefs and knowledge are different in that knowledge is what comes out of science. And in the book, while reading the chapter, I read this one line, if I could find it in my notes. It says, science tells us what is or something, and then our beliefs
tell us what should be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that beliefs should be relative, in that if we didn't have certain beliefs, why are we going on? Like, my beliefs motivate my life. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm speaking personally. But I know that I can't prove, because I believe in God. I know that I can't prove that God exists, but believing in God and believing that
my family and my boyfriend like truly love me, that helps me go on with my life. But whereas this chemical reaction is going to happen in a lab, that's my knowledge. Like, I know that's going to happen because I can prove it in science. So I think that beliefs and knowledge are kind of different.
Yeah, you can make some good points. James is just saying you should believe without evidence. You have a belief, but you don't have knowledge.
Yeah.
And maybe someday, like if you die and you're in the presence of God, there's your knowledge. You get confirmation. But you can't. James' point is you can't just sort of put it off over your whole life, because you'll be at your deathbed thinking, I wonder if there is a God or not, and then you die, right? And then you either find out or you don't. But you go through a whole life, James would say you're missing out on stuff. You're missing out on a life of hope, of knowing that you'll see your loved ones again, on moral fortitude to sort of help you stick to your principles when you're tempted not to. James would say all the benefits of the religious life, which he means. So I think mainly they have to do with like the hope of eternal life.
Like with morality too, if we didn't believe in our own personal rights and wrongs, I think it'd be fairly difficult for each individual to make any decisions at all. So that's a belief. We can't prove that what we know is right and what else is wrong, but that helps us make decisions in life.
Mm-hmm. And you know, if you think about the idea of morality, like just think about, you know, something horrific that happened in the news, or some horrible thing that some person did to another person. Like, what horrific events are in the news today? Think about. Anybody read the news today or over the weekend?
Horse meat.
People forced eat horse meat. I have a hard time getting exercise about that, because I don't think about horses as being special, any more special than cows or dogs.
People eat horses all over the world.
They're really big in France. I'm a vegetarian, so that would not be there's something in there about a living option or something. I don't know. But for me to care more about horses than other animals might be tough.
I'm a vegetarian. I think that's a little more messed up.
Really, the horses?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, I think it's all.
But you think the dogs are worse? Maybe because the horses are smarter, more conscious,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, I think they have a higher intelligence than chicken.
The chicken, yeah. Okay, I can see that.
Are you going to say a horse life is worth more than a cow life?
I don't know if I would say it's worth more. I'd just say it might be it's a little more in your face.
So
if it was put on this planet, we should eat it.
Well, how about the cannibalism case? There was a guy who was planning to abduct women and eat them, like for dinner. So think about Jeffrey Dahmer, right? He was abducting teenage street hustlers from the street, male, and wanted them to turn into sex slaves. And so he like drugged them, and then he like drilled a hole in their head and poured acid into it, so they're sort of like a mindless zombie and had sex with them. So now you think about that, you're like, oh, that's so revolting, right? And then you think, that guy ought to get, you know, the death penalty or something. You hear about something, you're either outraged or disgusted. To think that that's just sort of like it's just a visceral reaction, and there's nothing more to it than, oh, that's the way you feel because that's just like your medulla oblongata sending some, you know, secreting some chemicals that are creating a fear flight response, and it's coming out into your sort of seeping into your cerebral cortex and masquerading as a moral sentiment. You know, it's kind of a weird idea. And to think that every outrage committed across the globe, it's just your feelings about that is just, there's nothing to do with morality. It's all sort of feelings. It's just kind of a weird thing. And when you start thinking that way, something inside you sort of dies. When you give up this idea there's such a thing as right and wrong, and you think, oh, it's just survival of the fittest. oh, it's, you know, if Saddam Hussein, you know, who's like putting people in wood chippers and dressing people up in Superman costumes and throwing them off the roof to see if they can fly, and then watching videos of it while he knocked back scotch with one of his mistresses, that, hey, whatever floats his boat, there wasn't anything wrong with it. It's just that's what sort of made him happy. And just make, you know, what am I going to do about it? I'll just make sure that somebody like that is living next door to me. Or I'm always going to be looking over my shoulder wondering if somebody like that might be next door to me. But it's just there's only normal and abnormal. There's not right and wrong, good or evil. That, I mean, that's a lot to give up for most people. And so to hold on to that idea that there is such a thing as justice and right and wrong and good and evil is something that sort of, I mean, in a way is necessary to be a fully functional, happy, psychologically healthy human being. Most people that have those sorts of beliefs end up sort of in a bad way and end up with problems later on down in life. They end up listening to death metal and taking a lot of drugs and, you know, cutting themselves. So let me just let's talk about Pascal's wager in a minute here. I'm just going to get a quick capture of the board so I can release it. The sun's out today because my camera's saying, "Whoa, it's too bright." Okay. It's really out of my class. So, somebody tell me while I'm doing this, what's Pascal's wager? And speak loudly, please. Somebody take a shot. Like, roughly, what's Pascal's wager say? It's an argument for God's existence, right? How does it? What does it have? What does it have to say about God's existence and why you should believe in God?
He tries to force people to believe in Christianity by reasoning that our concern with truth, he kind of made it resemble like the stakes in a game of chance,
mm-hmm.
and like. Human reason kind of tells us what to believe, so we have to like kind of weigh out our gains and losses and our pros and cons before believing something.
I wouldn't necessarily say force. You said it tries to force people to believe in God.
Well, that's like what I read. It says that Pascal tries to force us into Christianity by reasoning as if our concern with truth resembled our concern with stakes in a game of chance.
Okay, so that's interesting because I'd forgotten that James had actually put it that way.
That's the quote, yeah.
Yeah. So I think I might disagree with James that, you know, depends on what you mean by force there. But he's trying to persuade us. I guess he's trying to force us in this sense is that he says, you gotta choose. One way or the other. It's like one of those forced options. And so there's four possibilities, or there's two possibilities. God exists. And God doesn't exist. And there's two bets you can place, right? Which is, are two ways you can bet. So you can believe in God, or you can not believe. So it's like, again, like a game of chance. It's like a roulette, and you can decide whether to believe in, you know, whether you want to place on red or black. Right. You spin the wheel and see where it comes up. And what you want to do is you want to win. And so how can you hedge your bets in the game of life, according to Pascal? Like what happens if you believe in God exists?
You make a happy life.
So you get the sign for infinity, infinite gain, he says. So you hit the jackpot. Good job. You go. Big, big win. What happens if you if God exists and you don't believe?
Loser.
Infinite loss, right? So God sends you to hell. You lose everything. Eternal punishment. And Pascal's a Catholic. So it's either hellfire and damnation. Now what happens if you don't believe in God and he doesn't exist? So this right here. So now, end game, no loss. So break even. Now how about this one here? This is a sort of special category. What happens if you believe in God, but it turns out he doesn't exist? Is it the same as this one or different?
No,
different.
Alright, so this was the break even one. Is this a break even or not?
No, you have some gains, but not losses.
Right, some gain. So you win, so it's some gain. So you win. But finite gain. Finite gain. You win some.
How do you win if you're having to do a false belief?
Because
it makes your life happier.
It doesn't create a good life,
though.
Sometimes.
That's a good question. Why does he say that? Why do you win some? Why do you win some?
Because your personal life is improved. Like, you believe in God, even though he doesn't exist, you're a happier person for believing.
That's assuming that religion makes your life better, which it doesn't.
Right.
Yeah, so that's
good. That's what he's persuading,
because
he's a Catholic himself.
Right, well, let's just hit a couple of these things. So I'll get to you all in just a second. He would say that here, that why is there a finite gain? So it's the benefits of the religious life. As Matt said, but then there's some in some disputation about whether religion makes your life better or not. Olive?
Well, in society, to be seen as religious can have positive effects on your status.
Mm-hmm. Depending on where you're at, right?
But more likely positive, especially when
I'm written.
Okay. Yeah, well, like today, it might depend on. But I mean, it's a good point, though, that maybe not as much in Eugene, but like if you're living in Texas or something.
Yeah, for sure.
Or Mississippi.
That might be a positive outlook.
There's some localities where on the books, you can't run for office if you're an atheist. There's a whimsical video. You can look at it's the I'll just recommend this to you. It's somewhat profane, but Cult of Dusty .com, or just look up Cult of Dusty on YouTube. And he has a thing where he says atheists are the new N-word, and basically talking about how atheists are the most hated category, and that you look at polls that people have hatred and bigotry towards atheists more than any racial minority. It's a kind of interesting thought. Anyway, that's a side topic. Benefits of the religious life, he would say. Again, hope for eternal life, moral fortitude, cohesion for the family, all those things that Pascal thinks will make your life better. And that James agrees with him on. We're in the middle of a point here, but I don't know. Let's get a new point, I guess.
Oh, well, like, religions, like, they kind of teach you how to, like, live, like, a good, just, moral life, and to, like, be a good person. That's where you get, like, the benefits in the end. And so, like,
like, I'm secular, so, like, because I don't necessarily believe in God, like, does that mean, like, because, but I do try to live, like, a just moral life.
Uh-huh.
So isn't that just the same amount of finite gains as someone that's being religious? Because we're both trying to do it as much good as we can.
I think the point is that's possible, but it doesn't necessarily happen. So if you believe in God, then you have to have that possible.
Yeah,
secularism, that's an option, but it's not necessarily going to happen.
I think they would argue that the belief in God also offers a lot of security in the fact that God cares about you. I mean, there's a lot of things
about it.
It gives you, I think you would say, it reinforces your belief in God. So Pascal might say it's not like that an atheist can't have principles, but it's that it sort of gives you a grounding or justification for those principles, and it sort of roots them in your behavior and gives you a little extra encouragement or a little push when you might get sort of weak in the knees and think, oh, I don't know, it'd be so easy to do this, but then you think if you're a religious person, oh, you know, I always feel so guilty and God would punish me. Whereas if you don't think there's a God, you're like, oh, well, even though I suppose this is what I should do, but here's what I really want to do, and if I'm really careful, I can get away with it. And so that's always a temptation when there's not this idea that you have a kind of a judge who's always going to catch you. I suppose also this idea of an ultimate arbiter of justice who will, who you don't want to let down. Or maybe, you know, there's people, it's not necessarily all about judgment, too. You know, a lot of religious people will say, I love God so much I can never screw over my neighbor. Because that would just be, you know, because it's because the love of God flows from me out to other people. And so it's hard for me, if I can't hate my, if I love God, I love my neighbor too. That's the two sort of go together. Anywho, we'll talk about criticisms of this argument next time and talk about Kierkegaard.
Not that we got to be a military and